From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Chicago teachers are officially on strike this morning as the city and the teachers union failed to make a deal. This comes after weeks of bargaining over more than just pay and benefits.
Meanwhile, 300,000 CPS students are out of class today due to this strike.
We went through point by point what's on the table so far, and our delegates overwhelmingly, unanimously reaffirmed that tomorrow will be the first day of a strike.
We've tried to provide the best deal that's fiscally responsible, that's fair to teachers and fair to taxpayers. Without question, the deal that we put on the table is the best in the Chicago Teachers Union's history.
That's Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot dealing with a Chicago Teachers Union strike in her first year in office. Before that, we heard from Jesse Sharkey, who's head of the CTU, and some NBC Chicago audio sort of describing the lay of the land. This comes as the mayor is making big requests of Springfield, of the General Assembly, to help her solve some big budget problems, which she's also set to be talking about in more detail soon. We're going to talk about that, and later in the program, take a deeper dive on the effort to consolidate downstate and suburban police and fire pension funds. This is State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. Sean Crawford is away. Joining us from the studios of NPR Illinois on the campus of the University of Illinois Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. On the line with us now from Chicago is Greg Hines, who covers politics for Crane's Chicago Business. Greg, welcome back to State Week.
Hey, Brian.
And later in the show, we'll be joined by Amanda Cass of the Government Finance Research Center, but that's for the deep dive on pensions. For now, the big news this week in Illinois, even though it's happening in Chicago, is the CTU strike. Greg, can you give us sort of an overview? What is keeping the union and the city or the school district from coming to an agreement here?
Well, essentially, it's about money and how much the mayor is willing to spend to cut class sizes and hire more ancillary workers, nurses, librarians, things of that nature. But what it's really about is who's going to call the shots and who's going to set the priorities over there, the union or the mayor. The union has had it stuck in its craw since the Pate Phillip days, these limits on their bargaining ability, the subject that the city has to talk about. And they want to change that in the worst way. They want to rebuild their car a little bit, too. They lost some when they backed the wrong horse for mayor earlier this year. They were for Tony Preckwinkle, and she got beaned, so they want to flex their muscle a little bit. And they want to be part of this emerging national movement. It's called Common Good, where school unions go out not just for themselves, but in theory to help their communities by getting other stuff like affordable housing aid, which is another thing that's on their list now. The problem with this is that CPS, while it's not broke now, it almost collapsed financially a couple of years ago. They've kind of clawed their way back to a sort of similar stability, and the word from those folks and the ratings agencies is that if they spend too much now, they could be back in the dumper almost immediately. And in fact, even now, their debt on Chicago Public Schools is still ranked as junk.
You know, so we had a strike some years ago under Rahm Emanuel, and I think there was a sort of a widespread view that he lost there. He caved to the teachers' union. Arguably, Bruce Rauner, that's what sort of motivated him and broke the straw that broke the camel's back and motivated him to run for governor. And as you talked about the limits on their bargaining, that's something he tried to bring to other school districts throughout the state. We know how that turned out. What do we have a sense of who's winning or losing? Where's public reaction to the strike? I realize as we go to air on Friday, it's only day two of this. But Greg, I wonder what sense do you have of where the people of the city are on this?
I'm not sure public opinion has quite crystallized yet. There's been a fair amount of back and forth. There's a lot of complicated issues that it's difficult for people to follow. I agree with you. If this is a long strike, though, Who knows how this is going to spin out? And I really can't call that one. But I completely agree with you that where public opinion eventually goes here, how much of her political capital is America willing to spend is the crucial issue. I mean, in some ways, she starts out in a lot better position than Rahm Emanuel. I mean, you know, he's a kind of arrogant white guy. She's a black woman who talks all the time about equity, so she has a lot of cred in the parts of the city where CTU is trying to really show its stuff. But how that's going to play out, too soon to tell for sure.
So I wonder, this strike comes as the mayor is trying to push a pretty big agenda in Springfield, right? She's got, I think she has said pretty directly that her view of the way the city needs to fix its finances runs through the General Assembly. We had news this week about her vision for ways that the gambling expansion law needs to change. And what does she want to do with a Chicago casino that's different from what is in the law that was negotiated and passed earlier this year?
Well, she wants to put it, the main thing she wants to do, at least if she's smart, she wants to put it back together. The city's proceeds, hundreds of millions of dollars a year from that casino, are supposed to go shore up the police and fire pension funds up here, which are very underfunded. That's one of the big reasons, extra money for those, that she now has an $823 million hole in the budget she's supposed to unveil on Wednesday. It's real clear that the tax structure passed by the General Assembly is too rich. There's a real concern. A state consultant pretty much said this, that nobody will bid on it because they're not going to make any money. So the question is how you change it. Probably the most obvious way to change it, and one that might conceivably get through the legislature, is, well, you reduce the tax structure, particularly the city's take. But she also threw a long ball. She made it clear that she wants to go to a structure in which the license for this would be held by governments, specifically by a commission jointly controlled by the city and the state. To kind of compound that, she really didn't fill in the governor on this, at least according to the governor, governor's people, and they're not wild about it in the best of circumstances. You know, I think that's a very long shot. Charlie would know better than I, because he's been in Springfield more and longer than I have, but it strikes into the idea of trying to give a license to Chicago, unlike anywhere else in the state, in a two-week veto session, is a standalone bill that doesn't have a bunch of other stuff in it for other parts of the state, is really tough. Hard sell.
Yeah,
well, what do you say,
I would
Charlie?
Say more than a hard sell. I would say it's probably impossible. Because years ago, when the notion of a casino in Chicago was first brought up, the city wanted to own it, and it was pretty soundly rejected down here. And the idea was that there would be too much temptation for Chicago politicians, were the city to own the casino, to do the kind of hanky-panky that gets them in trouble with the federal government. And so the idea was that you would have some private corporation own the license and run the casino, and the state and the city would profit off the taxes. So I think the notion that suddenly we're going to say, okay, city, you can own the casino, that's not going to fly at all. And even getting the tax structure changed will be tough because, as you mentioned, Greg, she wants kind of a standalone bill.
Right.
In my memory, there's never been a standalone bill to do anything about gaming that the ones that ultimately passed that were still standalone. Going back, I don't know, like 30 years when the question arose that we want to be able to leave our boats parked at the dock and not have to go out on the river, that wound up with a huge Christmas tree of stuff affecting gaming
yeah.
all over the place.
Yeah, you're right. It shouldn't be that way, but gambling bills in particular, it's always, well, you know,
oh,
why
sure.
should I do something for you? What are you going to do for me?
Exactly. And that's it. And if there's nothing in it for me, why should I vote to help you? But if you want to help me, I'd be glad to help you.
And we're seeing, Greg, that there have been some complications in terms of implementing the plans, the best laid plans in these this sort of gambling deal in terms of there was a supposed to be a horse racing track in Tinley Park that the governor basically pulled the plug on after a Tribune report about the impresario behind that, doing work with somebody who had been implicated or linked to mob banking. I mean, I don't want to get too far out here, but I mean, this is something that's still an issue in flux, right? The horsemen are disappointed now.
Yeah, I mean the financial question behind all this gambling is the state and municipalities are counting on a windfall here, you know, and maybe they would have gotten a windfall 25 years ago, but there's all kinds of other gaming around now. Internet gaming on sporting venues already started in Indiana. We're supposed to have it here, but it seems to be caught in the bureaucracy. But, you know, it's like any other business. The more competition it is, the less than any one outlet gets. So, you know, how well those casinos are really going to do in the end is an open question.
Well, I think, didn't the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, the legislative fiscal gurus, in one of the recent reports on gaming, say that, and this didn't include the sports betting, but all the talk about expanding gambling, more positions at existing casinos, new casinos, in the long run would bring in the tens of millions of new dollars. There would be a big windfall of a sorts in the beginning where you're selling these licenses for a ton. But when they're up and going, like you said, there's just so much competition that it's not going to grow dramatically the way it did years and years ago.
Yeah, I used to have a friend who would, whenever we'd have a business idea, he'd say, "That's great. We could make hundreds of dollars." Charlie, I want to come back to something.
I suppose it depends on how many zeros are at the end, right?
Yeah. Charlie, I want to come back to something Greg mentioned, which is the mayor reportedly surprised the governor. The administration says the governor learned about this when he read about it in the papers, which I guess one cheer for supporting newspapers. But Charlie, you've been a student of the way Chicago mayors have interacted with the General Assembly and the governor over the years. How would you assess Mayor Lightfoot's approach to working with Springfield?
I guess I'd say it's maybe what you would expect from someone who's never been involved in a political office, never been elected to high office like that, and maybe not realizing the importance of touching base ahead of time. Because that's the kind of thing, it would have been so easy to have the mayor or someone, you know, in her administration call somebody in the governor's administration and say, "Hey, look, we're going to talk about this. We just wanted to give you a heads up." That's just, in my mind, that's kind of basic politics 101. Why they didn't do that, I don't know. Because there's nothing lost in telling the governor ahead of time what you're going to do, and there could be a lot gained, because I'm sure that there are people in the governor's office who are very miffed about the fact that she sprung this on them through the newspapers. Although, like you said, as a newspaper reporter for many, many years, I'm happy that he found out about it in the newspaper.
Greg, I wonder, so what is this in conjunction? Last week we talked a little bit about some revelations, and we've continued to have a drip, drip, drip about the federal investigation that I guess we used to think centered on State Senator Martin Sandoval, but maybe that's just because we happen to see that's where the raids took place, that there is now a pretty wide-ranging investigation. We're heading into veto session. We know Mayor Lightfoot has some asks. We know that Commonwealth Edison and Exelon had big plans at one point for veto session. I wonder, what are we hearing about how that particular investigation, as we now have details about its spread and scope, and we mentioned that horse race track in Tinley Park that got quashed this week. What do we know, Greg, about how that could affect the upcoming work in the legislature?
Well, this week's big development, I thought, was that emerging scandal in the investigation took down a very senior executive at Commonwealth Edison, Exelon, the parent company of ComEd, Ms. Pamela Gagari. You know, she just got her job as the boss a year ago, and all of a sudden this week, after revelations that a lot of Commonwealth Edison records have been subpoenaed as part of this investigation, she suddenly quits. Now, anybody who follows Springfield knows that that company is very dependent on regulators and on legislative action, and has not been at all shy about trying to enlist friends and hire folks to improve its lot. Senator Sandoval's daughter worked for the company. A former Chicago alderman, who named Mike Zaleski, who's close to Speaker Madigan, was hired as a lobbyist. And she kind of was in charge of that. Now, whether anything improper occurred, it's hard to tell. But, you know, in the corporate world, when you've just hired a boss, something unusual is going on when you fire them less than a year later. So there's clearly something going on. This investigation has all kinds of tentacles. Where it's going to end up is unknown, but this has moved from just beyond the legislative and political environment into big business.
Well, it's also involved a lot of local government officials, right, in the southwest suburbs, and some of their contacts with lobbyists and businesses.
Yeah, and red light camera companies, and we saw this week a state legislator from the suburbs, a Republican, is trying to now push legislation that would ban red light cameras effectively in a lot of places. So that is something we're going to continue to watch. Greg, there was one other bit of interesting news I thought this week. The governor released his income tax returns. The man is reportedly worth $3.4 billion, if you believe the Forbes estimate. Is that basically the picture of him we get from these summaries of his tax returns that we got?
Well, you don't, because while JB is the governor's is a wealthy man, much of his wealth, most of his wealth, appears to be tied up in family trusts, where he and other and siblings of his all have a piece of it, and those tax reports are not made public. Now, when he releases his, he'll include some other details about occasionally about what happened to them. In this case, he said they paid, $35 million in federal tax and some state tax. But there's a lot of things that we don't know about that. So, you know, and legally that's all proper. It's not until the trust actually distributes money to its beneficiaries that the beneficiaries have to report it, which is why he only reported about a relatively small income this year. But there's a lot there that we frankly just don't know, and I'm not sure we're ever going to know it, for good or bad.
And I thought you had an interesting take on this and your story on it, that, you know, the governor is using his tax returns to sort of pitch this graduated income tax. And then if we can, you know, kind of circle back, I mean, this is something that's going to be on the ballot next fall. What do you think of his argument? And then I also wonder if we were talking before we went to air here about Mayor Lightfoot and the situation she's dealing with in Chicago, if that could potentially affect the graduated income tax pitch.
I got a chuckle out of what he did. He said in the course of releasing his tax returns that, you realize that if you pass my graduated income tax, I would have had to pay another $3 million. You know, that's kind of a big clear message. See, we really are soaking the fat cats like me. That is reasonably convincing up to a point, although the other side is going to say, hey, that once you lift this constitutional ban on graduated income, you make it easier to tax everybody, not just rich people. What I think is interesting is how this all plays into what's going on here in Chicago. The mayor's got this terrible situation. Depending on how the school strike adds, we're going to have some tax increases to pay for that. Depending on how her new budget next week comes out, we're going to have to pay some new taxes for that. She already did this morning rolled out a $40 million tax on Uber and Lyft and other ride-sharing firms, ride-hailing firms. If there's too many taxes from too many directions, it's going to make it very easy, I think, for the opponents of the graduate income tax to say, not another penny from anybody. We're sick to death of it. And, you know, and maybe that may not be true on paper, but it's certainly going to make it easier to demagogue this whole thing and say, you know, we're disgusted. No more taxes, period, and vote no. That's the nightmare scenario for this governor.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Brian Mackey with Charlie Wheeler and Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business. And joining us on the line from California, where she is a part, I guess, of the alleged Illinois exodus, is Amanda Cass. She is Associate Director of the Government Finance Research Center at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And even though she's based in California, I would probably put her in the 99th percentile still of people who follow Illinois government budget news. Amanda, welcome back to State Week.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So you wrote a post this week, is consolidating the assets of Illinois' public pension funds a good idea? This followed a task force report that came out last week. We just briefly touched on at the end of last week's program, but can you kind of give us the background here? What are these public pension funds and what is their status?
Sure. So Illinois has hundreds of public pension systems and is unique in that there are over 600 individual pension funds for police officers and firefighters. And they're kind of referred to as the public safety funds. And in general, most of the public safety funds are pretty underfunded. And to shore up the finances, municipalities' contributions into the funds are having to increase over time, creating some fiscal pressure for municipalities. So a task force was put together by Governor Pritzker to look at consolidating the funds. So instead of having 600-plus individual funds, consolidating them, and whether or not consolidation would generate some savings and help boost the finances of the pension systems.
So you asked the question in your analysis of this. I'll put it to you directly. Is this a good idea?
I think so. One, it's hard to know whether it's a good or bad idea without seeing a detailed plan. Mm-hmm. So the task force report had two general recommendations. One is consolidating the assets of the public safety funds. And so the idea is the assets would be combined and pooled together for investment purposes, but the individual funds would kind of still remain in terms of determining things like disability issues and an overall accounting of their assets and liabilities. So it's not full consolidation. And then the second recommendation was to address an issue with the second reduced benefit tier and increasing the benefits. I think in general, both of those proposals could be really good policy, but the devil's always in the details. So I really want to see the legislation to kind of weigh in whether or not it's prudent.
Yeah. And Greg, you wrote about this idea of the tier two fix or change last week. This is a problem that goes beyond these local pension funds potentially, though, right?
Yeah, it is. One of the few things the state has gotten right in the last three or four decades on pensions is in 2011, we passed a new pension plan that affected all new employees that sharply reduced their benefits and forced them to pay more. But there's been concern ever since, and people have talked about this privately, but it's the first time I've ever really seen it emerge in public, that the benefits that are being offered are so small that we're violating federal law, because right now a lot of public employees don't pay into Social Security, they pay into these public plans, but in exchange, the public plans have to give them at least what Social Security would. Well, there's some reason now to think that the benefits under Tier 2 are so cheap that they're not. So that means we're going to have to go back and revisit a lot of these plans and put some more money in. Now, the governor's task force concluded that it would cost up to $90 million over some years to shore up these local police and police and fire pension funds that they want to consolidate the investments for. But there's some other big funds that would be affected, most notably TRS, the statewide teachers retirement system that pays for all teachers outside of Chicago and increasingly contributes to Chicago. A lot of teachers don't qualify for Social Security. They've only put it into this fund. Well, if they have to go back and sweeten those benefits, you're talking about some big money here, potentially. I mean, I haven't done an actuarial study, and I'm not aware that anybody else has, but I could easily see it running into the hundreds of millions of dollars, which constitutes a little more bad news on the pension front for a state that needs anything but.
Yeah, and the problem is that if we don't do it, we're going to face the penalties from the Social Security. And the reason I think that the state prefers not to have, well, like state university employees, teachers, a few state employees in Social Security is because the state can skip payments into the teacher's retirement system or the state university retirement system, but you can't skip the payments to Social Security or you go to jail.
And Amanda, local governments don't have that option, right, of just skipping payments. And can you talk a little bit about, I mean, if there's no action here, if there's no legislation to follow up on this suggestion, what are the consequences for municipalities that have these pension funds?
So under state law dictates what municipalities are supposed to put into the local public safety funds each year. And until fairly recently, though, there was nothing that enforced those payments. So municipalities could kind of just short their pension systems without real repercussion, and they did. But starting in 2016, if the municipality shorts the pension system, the local pension board can request the state comptroller to intercept the revenue and redirect it to the pension fund instead to make up for that shortfall. And we've seen that action get triggered in a few places, most recently East St. Louis. And the places where it has been triggered are communities that really have already existing fiscal issues and limited fiscal capacity. So they're not in a position to make the pension payments and kind of meet their operations without significantly cutting services. So I think consolidation is not going to resolve that problem completely. It's not going to resolve the fiscal pressure of pension contributions, especially for communities with little fiscal capacity. I think it will possibly create some savings and help the situation a little bit, but I don't, whether or not consolidation happens, it's not going to resolve the issue completely.
Hmm.
Well, didn't St. Louis lay off a bunch of firefighters just the other day? And say that
they did, and it's a similar. So the East St. Louis story is a bit similar to what happened in the city of Harvey. Of the pension systems in Harvey requested the intercept, and in response to having state sharing revenue intercepted, the city laid off a large portion of its workforce, including police officers and firefighters. And it's notable because for Harvey, the state sharing revenue was something like 25% of its operating budget. You know, so think about suddenly having a quarter of your budget, a quarter of your income taken away, and how can you kind of keep operations going?
Yeah, and for most cities, the major cost in their budget is personnel cost.
Yeah, Amanda's right here that this is going to help, but it's not going to solve the problem. What's ultimately going to solve the problem, if we can't reduce the benefits that the Supreme Court will let us, or if we can't declare bankruptcy somehow, which a lot of conservatives want to do, but appears not to be in the cards. The only way to deal with this is to pay up, and to pay up when you're supposed to, because when you postpone the payment, it gets more expensive. Illinois actually has one fund that works pretty well. It's the IMRF, the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund, which covers non-public safety employees from most municipalities. But the way it works is they take a look at what the actuaries say every year, and if you're not paying enough, the municipality has to pay more. I mean, that way at least there's some discipline to ensure that you don't get into these terrible situations we're in now where the debts are almost overwhelming. But that's not a feature of what's in Governor Pritzker's proposal, at least not now.
And we're going to have to leave it there. That is our time for this edition of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Greg Hines of Crane's Chicago Business, and Amanda Cass of the Government Finance Research Center at UIC. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.